Chapter 5. Dorothy Kilgallen certainly knew that Marilyn Monroe had become a force to be reckoned with in the entertainment world since, by 1953, she had leading roles in such films as Niagara, which promoted her sex appeal, and the comedies Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and How to Marry a Millionaire, where her soprano laugh promoted the dumb blonde image. To gain an inside look at Marilyn, 26 at the time, one may watch the videotape of a little-known party that bandleader Ray Anthony gave for her at his home in 1952 when she was filming Niagara. Wearing a low-cut, red, form-fitting dress with her fluffed-up hair blowing in the wind, and that infectious smile greeting everyone who wanted to meet her, Marilyn is seen petting a cute brown and white collie, posing for photographs, smiling that radiant smile of hers, and even attempting to play the drums alongside, it appears, Mickey Rooney, as Anthony plays his famous trumpet. That she was the darling of the party is an understatement. Regarding the dumb blonde image, Marilyn didn't seem to care at the time. However, writing in My Story, she stated, "I was young, blonde, and curvaceous, and I had learned to talk huskily like Marlene Dietrich, and to walk a little wantonly, and to bring emotion to my eyes when I wanted to." But Marilyn did care. In December of 1953, presented with the opportunity to co-star opposite Frank Sinatra in the production of Pink Tights, she walked out of the production, objecting to the script's role for her, to her lack of any director approval, and to the salary. Retaliating, 20th Century Fox, her studio at the time, suspended her. Half-sister Bernice stood up for Marilyn, writing in her book, "Marilyn was not a dumb blonde. She was thoughtful and determined and a workaholic. She insisted on perfection from herself in her scenes. Her insistence frustrated several of her directors who were happy with the first take and to suffer through dozens more at her request." Bernice added, "On the set, Marilyn was her own slave driver. Off the set, over her lifetime, she allowed herself very few vacations. She was not a social butterfly and stayed too busy to do much dating. Marilyn's constant reading only seemed to earn her criticism and ridicule. The real Marilyn was thought to be the phony one." Bernice's account of Marilyn cross-references with a quote in Kilgallen's Voice of Broadway column published in late August 1965, 4 months before Kilgallen died. She wrote, "In Nunnally Johnson's introduction to Edwin P. Hoyt's Marilyn Monroe bio, Marilyn, the Tragic Venus, he writes, 'I knew one Marilyn who was a blinding headache. I knew another who was an angel child.'" Johnson's credibility may not be questioned. He was a motion picture producer, screenwriter, and director, best known and revered as a writer for The Grapes of Wrath, 1940, and The Woman in the Window, 1944, which were considered his best screenplays. He also produced Marilyn's film How to Marry a Millionaire, 1953. During the 1950s, Johnson started to direct, as well as to write and produce, The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, 1956, The Three Faces of Eve, 1957, and The Angel Wore Red, 1960. His final script was for The Dirty Dozen in 1967. Published in 1965, Hoyt's biography of Marilyn was released at a time when facts about her life and times and death were not polluted with phony sensationalism, as would be the case with many articles and books in the future. His account certainly appears credible due to the large number of primary sources included in his foreword and acknowledgments. Besides interviewing studio executives, producers, directors, and stars of the day who knew Marilyn personally, Hoyt, whose superb powers of recollection may be relied upon due to his extensive research, went so far as to contact a number of officials of the Los Angeles public school system to track down information about Marilyn's brief educational days. Hoyt also spoke with Marilyn's hairdresser, Agnes Flanagan, Hazel Washington, Marilyn's studio maid for a number of films, and even Fred Karger, her orchestra leader and musical director, regarding his memories of the movie star. First up in the book was Hoyt's perspective of what he dubbed the real Marilyn, very insightful, to say the least. He wrote, "The woman was artificially blonde. She had no family to speak of, almost no friends, and only a handful of family acquaintances. No sycophants surrounded her because she had little money, although she earned money easily and spent it lavishly. She was a friendly, shy creature who sometimes impressed strangers as vulgar, sometimes as lost and bewildered, sometimes as lush and inviting. She was known to cry at the sight of a dead animal on the roadside, and she was known to keep scores, dozens, hundreds of people waiting for as long as 3 hours while she primped in the privacy of her apartment. She had grown up in the most insecure of circumstances, an unwanted child of an unbalanced woman, shuttled between foster homes and an orphanage. Insecurity lay at the center of her character, so deep-seated that it affected her every action." Based on the number of people Marilyn would have called friends, Hoyt may have been wrong regarding his observation that she had none, but otherwise his vision of Marilyn appeared right on point. One bit of fresh information Hoyt provided was his understanding that she had been offered and rejected a Las Vegas nightclub's offer for an engagement at $55,000 per week, just before the calendar turned to August 1962. Apparently the money, tantamount to nearly $500,000 in today's currency, was not the issue, but the overhead involved with paying her supporting staff, including hairdressers, a makeup man, secretary, press agent, acting coach, and personal maid, all of whom would have had to be transported to Vegas. Nonetheless, the potential deal suggested that Marilyn's life was on the upswing at that point. Hoyt confirmed other accounts that Marilyn was, for the most part, frugal. He wrote that she did not need an extensive wardrobe. She was happy enough in a pair of blue jeans and a cotton shirt and sandals. He added that she limited her monthly outlay to $100 a month for spending money, about $900 a month today, while reporting that Marilyn's household expenses were quite sparse, including $200 for wines, liquors, and cocktail snacks, with her drink of choice when she drank, which was not often, normally champagne. Regarding Marilyn's appearance, as August 4, 1962 approached, Hoyt, having calculated that she was 36 years, 2 months, and 3 days old at that point in time, wrote that she was healthy and relatively happy, more beautiful and more glamorous than before. He continued, "Her girlishness was unlimited. She came through, as they said in Hollywood, a salute to her acting ability. She weighed 117 pounds, and she stood 5 feet 5.5 inches in her stocking feet." Hoyt did not mention, for whatever reason, a Marilyn staple, a childlike laugh endearing to most everyone she met. While all of Marilyn's films are memorable, There's No Business Like Show Business, released in 1954 and featuring music and lyrics by Irving Berlin, provides insight into the magic of Marilyn on the big screen and the definite connection, as noted, another similarity revealed here for the first time, between the lives of the movie star and the famous reporter Kilgallen. The film, set circa 1920, follows the lives of a vaudeville pair of entertainers, the Donahues, and their two children as they attempt to hit the big time. This connection deals with the fact that one of the children is played by singer Johnny Ray, with whom Kilgallen would have a torrid love affair. He appears 24 minutes into the film in a tuxedo playing the piano and singing the classic Alexander's Ragtime Band. Ray, as son Steve Donahue, later tells his disapproving parents he wants to forsake the vaudeville stage and become a priest. 5 minutes later, Marilyn, cast as Vicky, a hat-check girl with aspirations to become an actress, appears on screen, that fabulous smile and sparkling blue eyes lighting up the scene. She is told by her agent that a well-known producer will be in the audience. To the surprise of the audience, Marilyn is brought on stage, where she displays a mischievous laugh and speaks in a sultry voice, the one she patterned after Marlena Dietrich. In response to an inquisitive man asking about her state of affairs as a hat-check girl, she smoothly replies, "I'm temporarily between engagements," and with sexy bravado, she continues with the line, "I've known what I'm doing since I was 6 years old." This remark reflects back on the young Marilyn who dreamed of myself becoming so beautiful that people would turn to look at me when I passed. While the first appearance of Marilyn, who later attended classes at UCLA in Renaissance art and literature to become, as she put it, smarter, in the film is memorable, the magic of her glow, of her star quality, of her being the only face in the crowd, of being a showstopper, happens when she hits the stage wearing a skin-tight silver dress that sparkles in the lights. The adorable smile, the perfect face, the golden hair complete with a silver plume, and the perfect body combine to throw an electric current into the audience as she sings, "After you get what you want, you don't want it." Swirling and slinging through a group of tables, sex pouring from her pores into the hearts and minds of adoring men, Marilyn is the star born, the princess, the dream girl of every man in the audience. When she cuddles up to the producer at his table, he is mesmerized, and following the knockout performance, he enters her dressing room, literally foaming at the mouth at her beauty and sex appeal. He believes he is talking to the most beautiful woman in the world, arguably the woman history may uphold as the most beautiful woman to have ever lived. Marilyn also sings Heatwave with similar glamour and sex appeal. But it was a scene with Donald O'Connor, playing the other Donahue son, that invoked recollections of past and future problems with men in general, and especially powerful men. When he tells her, "Don't worry, you'll make it in show business. You've got what it takes, and you know how to use it," Marilyn bites back, telling him, "You get out of here," furious that he believes only her sexual nature will lead to stardom. Like Kilgallen, who didn't possess Marilyn's beauty but was beautiful in other ways while becoming a powerful media force, Marilyn faced gender issues, especially regarding the slim paycheck each received for their work when compared to what men were paid. In 1954, Monroe had stood up for herself by refusing a role unless she was not only paid more but stripped of being typecast as the dumb blonde. For this, Marilyn, as noted, had been suspended by the studio. A year later, however, she hit the jackpot when her appearance in The 7-Year Itch was a box office home run. In that film, set in the middle of a heat wave, a New Yorker, Tom Ewell, alone after his wife and son leave for Maine, encounters a gorgeous blonde model, Marilyn, who has moved into the apartment upstairs. But how did Marilyn hit the home run? On September 15, 1955, the famous scene of Marilyn laughing as her skirt was blown up by the blast from a subway vent had been captured during the filming of the movie in New York City. Other than the photo by Billy Woodfield of her climbing out of the pool nude in Something's Got to Give, it was the moment in time those who loved Marilyn would never forget. It's no wonder the skirt flying high didn't bother Marilyn. At an early age, first husband Jim Doherty said he told his wife, "You don't have any panties on," when she left for a modeling assignment. She looked at him and said with a straight face, "No, I don't. They look crude showing through my dress. I think it's vulgar for those things to be showing through your clothing." During this time, an interview with Marilyn in Variety provided a special insight into her mindset while filming The 7-Year Itch. "Do I feel happy in life? Let's say I hope I am finding happiness. For me, if I can find things I like in my work, I come the closest to being happy. And I can also say that about my life. I think it only happens in moments. Sometimes when I'm working and I'll be able to fulfill a scene truthfully and then think I am the happiest. I find it is stimulating to keep studying and working, but I'm not just generally happy. If I'm generally anything, I guess I'm generally miserable." I don't know. I would like to be more sociable than I am on some days. Sometimes I'll chat when I'm not pleased. Sometimes the work requires that I'm quiet and to myself, and other days, like in a musical number, I like to be more outgoing because that's what I have to express. I could easily be alone. It doesn't bother me to be alone. Some people I know, they don't like to be alone. I don't mind it. I think there are two things in human beings, as there is in myself, that they want to be alone and they also want to be together. You know, I also have a gay side to me, also a sad side. And I think that's the way with most people, but there is something in people, they do need solitude. Proof that Kilgallen had been keeping her eye on Marilyn's career for some time is a little-known column the reporter published a few months earlier, on April 4, 1955, 7 years before Marilyn would die, in the Chicago American, an extension of her Voice of Broadway column in the New York Journal American, both published by the Hearst Syndicate. Though the printing is blurry, one may read the title Cigar Puffs for La Monroe. The column includes a photo of the actress as well. The first few lines read, Marilyn Monroe, who barely needs anything further to attract attention, has a new bit that makes wide eyes grow wider. When her ever-present escort, Milton Green, lights up a cigar, Marilyn borrows it and takes little puffs at the stogie. Green was a well-known photographer who became a close friend of the actress. Often mentioned in Kilgallen's Voice of Broadway column, Marilyn was a true trailblazer for women's rights, like the famous journalist. She had the courage to stand up for what she believed in and had decided to take control of her life by starting a production company. In late 1955, Fox came through with a new contract permitting her more control over the parts she played. During this period of time, Marilyn wrote in My Story, In Hollywood, a girl's virtue is much less important than her hairdo. You're judged by how you look, not by what you are. Hollywood's a place where they'll pay you $1,000 for a kiss and 50 cents for your soul. I know, because I turned down the first offer enough and held out for the 50 cents. Such insightful comments mimicked more somber ones she offered with photographer Milton Green and his wife Amy at their home for the program Person to Person with Edward R. Murrow, as Kilgallen would do 1 year later and John and Jacqueline Kennedy had done in 1953. The YouTube version of Marilyn's appearance portrays the girl-next-door image of the actress in 1955, the sweet, rather shy Marilyn, more of the human Marilyn. Just 7 years removed from her death, she exhibited throughout the interview the sleepy voice that was her trademark, and the perfect smile that captured the hearts of so many. Amy Green, when asked what kind of a house guest Marilyn was, answered, Ideal guest. She's not troubled anyone, picks up after herself, she helps me with the baby, to bathe him, feed him. The latter comment, evidence of Marilyn's love for children, will be explored in the coming sections. Regarding career aspirations, Marilyn said, I don't object to musicals or comedies, but I'd like to do some dramatic as well. When asked about the experience of riding a pink elephant through Madison Square Garden in New York City for a circus charity event, the TV viewing audience may well have responded with sympathy for her when she replied, It meant a lot because I hadn't been to the circus as a kid. Critically acclaimed roles ensued and included leading parts in Bus Stop and The Prince and the Showgirl before she won a Golden Globe for Best Actress in Some Like It Hot. The pressures of show business were stumbling blocks Marilyn had trouble bearing. She was often late on the movie sets, had trouble remembering her lines, and caused difficulty for directors by demanding take after take of certain scenes. Soon rumors circulated that Marilyn was using barbiturates, amphetamines, and alcohol to alleviate her anxiety, her fears caused by bullying tactics employed by those who used her not only to promote their own careers but in a sexual manner. One eyewitness to Marilyn's state of mind at the time was celebrated actor Laurence Olivier, who starred with her and directed the film The Prince and the Showgirl. In a YouTube interview, he offers a seasoned perspective with a frankness few others could match. Marilyn was a very curious little person, divided person. When I first met her, I thought she was the most enchanting person I had ever met, and it was impossible to not fall a little bit in love with her. I so looked forward to working with her, witty actress as well as being so ravishingly beautiful. It wasn't enjoyable. She was always late, sometimes 4 hours late, not just something naughty, something chronic, a problem. Marilyn was rather bad-tempered. People got rather frightened of her. I would get frightened of her. But she was marvelous at saying a line, 7 words, etc. She was just herself in the beginning, and I think that precious self was destroyed through studio study. Marilyn was a very mixed-up kid at the time. Picture done, on budget. Asked her to take 2 days and reshoot some scenes. She agreed. Marilyn was a model forced to be an actress. Had a still session, and she was like an angel. She was childlike but marvelous, sort of this gay, light, sweet, irresistible person. Dorothy and Marilyn shared a friendship with actress Joan Crawford, but in 1953, when Marilyn had worn a skin-tight gold lamé dress to an event, Crawford chastised her for conduct unbecoming an actress and a lady. This comment extended to the style of clothes Marilyn often wore, and to help the young actress, Crawford said, "Taste is every bit as important as looks and figure. Will you let me help you, my dear?" And the crusty Crawford, who attended the same church as Marilyn visited, did so, telling her after one church service, "I'm so glad to see you, but you mustn't come to church in flat heels and a gray suit with black trimming. If you wear gray, you must wear different gray tones, but never black." Marilyn wrote in My Story, "It was my only suit, but there was no sense defending on that ground." During a visit to Crawford's home for lunch, Joan told Marilyn, "The main thing about dressing well is to see that everything you wear is just right, that your shoes, stockings, gloves, and bag all fit the suit you are wearing. It's so easy not to look vulgar." Then she asked Marilyn to send her a list of all her clothes options, so I can guide you a bit. Embarrassed at not being able to make such a list, she wrote that she did not call Crawford again. When asked to be a presenter at the Academy Awards a year later, Marilyn incurred Crawford's wrath when she did so. Apparently, the star of such films as Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, Mildred Pierce, and Grand Hotel told the media, "Marilyn Monroe's vulgar performance at the Academy Affair was a disgrace to all of Hollywood." Marilyn also recalled Crawford saying that she was wearing a dress too tight for me and wriggling my rear when I walked up holding one of the holy Oscars in my hand. This caused Marilyn to telephone friends, who defended what she wore while advising me to forgive a lady who had once been young and seductive herself. Like many others, Kilgallen took a pot shot at Marilyn on occasion, but usually in jest. One day when Marilyn was lunching at the Plaza Hotel, John Dosher, a bartender there, said he was awestruck by the entourage of photographers, hairstylists, and makeup artists accompanying Miss Monroe each time she came in. Kilgallen was sitting nearby, and Dosher mentioned to her that Monroe was sitting by the window. He recalled that Kilgallen jokingly let out a harrumph before adding, "Yes, I saw her. She looks like an unmade bed." Marilyn would likely have disagreed with Kilgallen, not only about her appearance, but also regarding criticism over her always being late for appointments, dinner, or on the movie set. In My Story, she defended herself, once again providing insight into the woman she had become separate from the movie star. She wrote, "When I have to be somewhere for dinner at 8 o'clock, I will lie in the bathtub for an hour or longer. 8 o'clock will come and go, and I still remain in the tub. I keep pouring perfumes into the water and letting the water run out and refilling the tub with fresh water. Sometimes I know the truth of what I'm doing. It isn't Marilyn Monroe in the tub, but Norma Jean. She used to have to bathe in water used by 6 or 8 other people. Now she can bathe in water as clean and transparent as a pane of glass. and it seems that Norma can't get enough of fresh bathwater that smells of real perfume. While success had finally discovered Marilyn, she discovered it wasn't all it was meant to be, perhaps akin, it would seem, to the song, "After You Get What You Want, You Don't Want It," she sang in There's No Business Like Show Business. In My Story, she wrote, "People began to treat me differently when I became famous. I was no longer a freak, a sort of stray ornament, like some stray cat to invite in and then forget. I was becoming important enough to be attacked. Famous actresses took to denouncing me as a sure way of getting their names in the paper. What was happening was that in working to make good, I had forgotten all about living. There was no fun anymore in anything. There was no love in me for anything or anyone. There was only success, beginning." When a friend at the Fox studio suggested in 1954 that she might like Joe DiMaggio, Marilyn wasn't sure whether he was a baseball or football star. The friend told her Joe was the idol of millions because he was one of the greatest names in baseball, but Marilyn said, "I don't like men in loud clothes with checked suits and big muscles and pink ties. I get nervous." Regardless, Marilyn decided to attend a small gathering DiMaggio had planned at Chasen's, a popular restaurant in Hollywood. Her reaction surprised her. "I had thought I was going to meet a loud, sporty fellow. Instead, I found myself smiling at a reserved gentleman in a gray suit with a gray tie and a sprinkle of gray in his hair. If I hadn't been told he was some sort of a ball player, I would have guessed he was either a steel magnate or a congressman." She then added, "He didn't try to impress me or anybody else. Mr. DiMaggio just sat there. Yet somehow he was the most exciting man at the table. The excitement was in his eyes. They were sharp and alert." When Marilyn announced she had to leave the restaurant, Joe asked if he could see her to the door, and when they were outside, to her car. There he asked Marilyn to drop him at his hotel, and she recalled, "My heart jumped and I felt full of happiness." The ride to the hotel turned into a ride around the area for 3 hours. He told her he'd seen her in a baseball promotion photo, and she said, "I imagine you must have had your picture taken doing publicity stunts like that 1,000 times. He made her laugh when he replied, "Not quite. The best I ever got was Ethel Barrymore and General MacArthur. You're prettier." Looking for love, Marilyn had found it in the strangest place, a baseball field. She had fallen deeply in love with the Hall of Fame hunk of an athlete and married him at City Hall in San Francisco on January 14, 1954. Since Joe had the type of huge, warm family atmosphere Marilyn missed growing up, she felt safe and secure for perhaps the first time in her life. The wedding night was spent in Paso Robles, California, located near the Pacific Ocean, halfway between San Francisco and Los Angeles. Author Edwin Hoyt wrote, "The couple went to the Paso Robles Hot Springs Hotel and ate steak. Marilyn wore slacks, a blouse, tan wraparound coat, and a kerchief over her head. To be sure that it was recognized that she did not want to be recognized, she wore dark glasses. A honeymoon to Japan, Marilyn's star shined bright there, was combined with Marilyn traveling to Korea, where she wowed more than 100,000 USO troops with several songs, including Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friends. Like Kilgallen, who recorded war bonds commercials at the end of World War II to help the American cause, Marilyn had become a true patriot. Ironically, Jolton Joe, as DiMaggio was known, appeared on What's My Line on September 18, 1955, a year after marrying Marilyn. Kilgallen, whom Tony Randall had introduced as the honorary chief of the New York Fire Department, an honor bestowed on her 3 days earlier, looked on as fellow panelist Arlene Francis, before asking her first question, commented on the huge applause given Joe when he scribbled his name on the show's chalkboard. Francis said, "Nobody's ever had a hand like that other than Eisenhower and Monroe," alluding, of course, to the famous Marilyn. As the show proceeded, DiMaggio was more animated than usual, laughing while answering questions in a boyish sort of way. Francis finally guessed his occupation. In My Story, Marilyn describes how publicity regarding her movie career led to the marriage's downfall a month before her divorce to DiMaggio was final. She wrote, "I have to be careful in writing about my husband Joe DiMaggio because he winces easily. Many of the things that seem normal to me are very annoying to him." After they were married, Joe had begun to object to Marilyn's look, including, she said, the low neckline of my dresses and skirts. In her book, she wrote, "I gave in on this one. I wear no more low-cut dresses. Instead, they have a collar. The neckline is an inch under my chin." This compromise on her part permitted the marriage to continue for a time, but finally Joe's demands sent her packing, sending her away from arguably the one man in her life who ever truly loved her. Next on the love front, Marilyn hooked up with playwright Arthur Miller of Death of a Salesman fame. Doing so caught the attention of the FBI, since Miller was being investigated by the House Un-American Activities Committee. Like Kilgallen, who showed courage when she supported comedian Lenny Bruce after his arrest for obscene language during a New York City performance, Marilyn refused to bow to the Hollywood studio boss's order to dump Miller. When Marilyn, whose face glowed when her blue eyes flashed in the sunlight, married Miller in 1956, 6 years before she was murdered, Kilgallen's Journal American colleague Walter Winchell wrote, "America's best-known blonde moving picture star is now the darling of the left-wing intelligentsia." The marriage would end up in divorce in 1961 after Marilyn apparently discovered Miller's open diary and learned of his disappointment in her and his being ashamed when he introduced her to his intellectual peers. He also wrote of other doubts about the marriage. That same year, while in London to star with Laurence Olivier in The Prince and the Showgirl, Marilyn was introduced to Queen Elizabeth, just as Kilgallen had been 3 years earlier. In a photograph taken of their meeting, it's difficult to know who is more impressed by who. Interestingly enough, Jim Doherty, who died in 2005, wrote of both DiMaggio and Miller in his book. He wrote, "Norma Jean was a girl who wanted peace, love, and happiness, probably in that order. And I don't doubt that she found love again after our divorce. Joe DiMaggio loved her tremendously. Arthur Miller must have loved her because he stood by her at the time when the strain of her health was beginning to show, and she needed more support than ever." Speaking broadly about Marilyn and love, Doherty wrote, "No doubt there were other men who loved her too, but peace and tranquility, security, the uncomplicated joy of just being alive— all those things, I believe, went out the window when she became an actress." He added, "I was impressed with her beauty on the screen as well as her skill, but I didn't associate myself with Marilyn at all because it was not the girl I knew. I never believed that Norma Jean had within her this kind of talent. It never dawned on me once. I was impressed with her singing and with her ability to carry her part as well as she did. She was so natural, so believable." In September 1960, Marilyn's film Let's Make Love was released, but movie fans seemed not to care. Poor reviews didn't help. Kilgallen's rival columnist, Hedda Hopper, who had said of Marilyn, "She hypnotized the camera," in another film review, called this film the most vulgar film Marilyn's ever done. While it is easy to brush over how Marilyn must have felt when the film was criticized by other critics, Hopper's biting comments would have stabbed Marilyn through the heart. By this time, she had worked so hard to establish herself as a first-rate actress who was much more than a sex symbol, and one may imagine tears flowing when she read Hopper's direct attack, which included the critic's belief that the film was the most vulgar of her career. Regardless, for whatever reason, the famous reporter was at 20th Century Fox Studios for the press conference announcing the release of the film. Proof exists through a photograph of her with Marilyn and her co-star, actor Yves Montand, on the Fox lot in September 1960. No matter the lack of success of that film, gifted director John Huston had selected Marilyn to star in The Misfits with Clark Gable. But what should have been a blessing was tainted since Marilyn, vulnerable and lonely, had fallen under the dark shadow of drugs triggered by an inability to sleep well. Deciding a change of scenery might brighten her day, Marilyn left the East Coast for Brentwood, California, where she made one of the worst mistakes of her life, dating Frank Sinatra for several months. Believing the move would help calm her worried mind, Marilyn purchased a home while agreeing to appear in the film Something's Got to Give, co-starring Dean Martin. Difficulties with her health kept postponing the production, and then she inflamed the producers and the studio by heading to New York City. There she sang the infamous Happy Birthday song in her gentle, haunting voice to President John F. Kennedy at Madison Square Garden, wearing a beige, skin-tight dress speckled with rhinestones that made her appear nude. This appearance will be described further in connection with Marilyn's death. Never afraid to push the envelope during her career, a characteristic she shared with Kilgallen, Marilyn appeared nearly nude in one of the most unforgettable scenes in movie history, the pool scene for Something's Got to Give. Photos of the scene were later published in Life magazine. Distressed at Marilyn's behavior during the production, the studio blamed her for its demise to the extent of spreading rumors that she was mentally ill and needed psychiatric help, which, as will be seen, would affect the truth about what happened to her when she died. Regardless, to prove the skeptics wrong, Marilyn was preparing to play in her next film, bewitching actress Jean Harlow, her childhood idol, in a biopic. It would never happen.